Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4 by 5 color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And, of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Michael Bryant. Michael is a fine art Holga photographer based out of Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to talk to Michael about his photography, his use of the Holga cameras, and all the great work he's doing. Michael, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photography. Great to have you on the show today. Michael, let's talk about yourself. You do fine art Holga photography. Is that how you would talk about what your photographic art is?
I am, yeah. I participate in outdoor art shows around the country, selling my artwork, whatever I've shot lately that sort of fascinates me that I'm showing at the time.
I know you went to the Art Academy in Atlanta, along with some other great photographers, Michael Jordan Smith, all kinds of people. Great stuff going on there. But what got Michael into the photography? What brought the interest to you to say, I want to shoot some images?
I went to the Art Institute in Atlanta, and I probably got started when I was a kid. I grew up in South Georgia, and we lived in England for a while when I was a kid. I was probably 12. And I think the environment was so different, it prompted me to take pictures. It really interested me, things that I maybe never would have noticed before, because it was so different from where I grew up and where I was used to being, that I started taking pictures, and it probably started there. So I was on the yearbook staff in high school. And then when it was time to decide where to go to college and what to do, the only thing I could think of to do for a living that I wanted to do was photography. So I moved to Atlanta, went to the Art Institute, and started doing commercial photography and weddings and portraits and meetings, all the photography that you do to earn a living. And then on the side, I started doing a couple of art shows, selling work that was just my work. I did that for a couple years, and then in 96, the Olympics came along, The Olympics were great for Atlanta, but they were bad for a lot of the businesses at that moment. When the Olympics are coming to town, people stop doing things that they normally do. They quit planning meetings in town around the time of the Olympics. They quit planning weddings around that time. Everything that I would normally photograph around that time just sort of ceased for about 6 months. So the small photography studios that I worked for couldn't keep me employed. And it was really just the sort of push I needed to just start doing art shows. So I started doing them exclusively then. And it took me a couple of years to get more of a cohesive body of work at the art shows. And within a couple of years, I had mostly just Polaroid transfers, which I enjoyed doing, but I was looking to get away from the Polaroids because I couldn't do larger sizes without doing some sort of reproductions. And I wasn't interested in doing reproductions. They weren't very flexible. So the Holga came along, and I could do larger sizes because it gave me a negative. I could do any size I wanted, and I liked that. And the images were sharper and clearer, believe it or not, in the larger sizes than they would have been with the Polaroids because of the rubbing process when you make a Polaroid transfer. Sometimes it's not as sharp as you might want it to be. And so then, since maybe 2000, I've done just Holgas for the most part. I love working with the Holga. It's great. It has all these limitations, which is exactly what I need to be creative. I think if I used a camera that could do everything, it's hard to pick and choose which of those things that the camera can do I use to be creative. This takes that out of my hands. The camera is very limited. You can't adjust the shutter speed. You can't adjust the f-stop. And you have to use sort of what the camera has and work around that to be creative. And that actually is fascinating to me. I enjoy that much more than I would if I was using, say, a camera that could do a million things.
Sure, because being at Art Institute there, you learned, I'm sure, all of the traditional photographic processes. I know you have some view camera images that we'll talk about here later on your website. So it's not like you don't know or have a choice on what to use. But I think the Holga represents, and what you've been able to do with your images is very cool. It has a great look to it.
Oh, certainly. When I was in school, the whole point of sort of the program that I was in was to learn about all facets of photography. So you used all sorts of different cameras. I bought my 4x5 when I was in school. I used Hasselblads and Mamiyas. I mean, I used all these different cameras to sort of understand all these different aspects of photography. We did model photography and product photography. So we did all that. I'm capable of doing all that, but that doesn't really fascinate me that much. In fact, I have an APA-10, I have a 4x5, I have a Hasselblad, but they really just sit there. I don't really use them very often because the Holga just fascinates me more. The fact that it's so limiting, that's much more interesting to me than going out to shoot with the Hasselblad and getting great sharply focused shots, which most anybody could do with a little bit of training. The fact that the Holga doesn't do any of that, the sharpness and the well-exposed images, I like the fact that what I've created with the Holga isn't something that just anybody could create with the Holga. Or it isn't something that most people could create with the Holga with a little bit of training. It's something that came more from me than it came from the camera. Whereas with a higher quality camera, they're made so well with a little bit of training, most people could find a way to take really fantastic photographs. But I don't think that's so true with the Holga.
Well, definitely so. You need to be much more creative. So before we get into the art shows and how all that stuff works out, I think a lot of people always have an interest in how that works. But let's continue on here with the equipment and the gear. So, Michael, tell me about gear. Let's talk about Holgas. Which ones do you like to shoot? I know they have better ones now with glass lenses. They have original ones. They're even making them camouflage now. I mean, there's a Holga explosion going on that I think is very creative. It's very economical for people to buy one and have fun. But let's talk about what you're using, what you like. Are you taping them up? What's your little tweaks? What do you like to do?
Well, I just use the basic Holga, all the other extras, and they're great and they're interesting. And if they help create interest in the Holga and people shooting film, then that's fantastic. I have nothing against that. But really, for me, it's just the basic Holga is all I use. It's just the bottom of the line. In fact, the last time I bought new ones was probably about 3 years ago, and they were $16.84 for them, and they've probably doubled in price since then.
I think they're about $30 now, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Even so, $30 as opposed to whatever the base model Hasselblad costs, it's still a great price.
Oh, yeah.
I tend to carry three of them with me all the time since you can't control the shutter speed, the f-stop. I'll shoot a couple different film speeds to help compensate for that. And I don't tape them up. Taping them up to me seems like it would be very gummy and it seems like it would be very messy if I was out shooting in Europe or wherever I would be shooting. I'm sure I wouldn't want to deal with all that tape and all that gum. So I use Velcro. So I glue a portion of the Velcro to the camera and then the other portion of the Velcro just pulls off. It's a little more expensive to do that. It's a little more time-consuming to sort of set that up. But in the end, it's much cleaner and easier. And actually, it holds the camera together probably a little bit better than the tape would. Because sometimes the film rolls funny in the back of the camera, and it will cause pressure, and then the back of the camera will want to sort of pop off a little bit. And Velcro will hold it together and keep that from happening. Because you don't want the back to pop off if you have film in there. That's a bad thing.
That's not good at all.
That's not good at all, yeah.
So let's talk about acquisition stock. What do you like to shoot film-wise?
I used to just shoot Tri-X. I really like Tri-X. I like the grain on the Tri-X. And then I started doing multiple exposures a couple of years ago, and Tri-X really only comes in one speed. And so it was too fast for some of the multiple exposures, so I started using T-Max 100. So I'll carry both of those. I've recently shot some color films, and frankly, I don't remember which ones they were. I was sort of experimenting with color, but color doesn't fascinate me that much, so I only shot one or two rolls, and I don't remember which ones they were. But mostly, it's Tri-X and T-Max. And the grain on the T-Max, it's a beautiful grain, but I do like how grainier the Tri-X is. So I try to use that whenever I can, but it just depends on what I'm shooting and what I think it calls for. I did used to shoot weddings with the Hasselblad, so you have to learn sort of the light weddings move quickly, and you tend to shoot the same sorts of settings over and over again, whether you're shooting couples or groups in the shade or in the sun. It tends to be the same environment over and over again, so you sort of learn what the light is if you're paying attention. And so now I can generally tell which film speed I need just by what the conditions are that I'm shooting in. And I'm pretty successful in getting good, well-exposed negatives most of the time.
So you don't even bother with a light meter. You just go out with your Holga and a pocket full of film and just let's go have fun.
Oh, yeah. I think my battery's dead in my light meter. I'm pretty sure it is. In fact, last time I looked at the batteries, I think they were corroded. So I'm not even sure if it would work if I pulled it out and used it. I tend to shoot in the same sort of lighting conditions most of the time. Everything's existing light. Everything's outside for the most part. So I tend to look for cloudy days. Some of the best images that I've shot recently were here in Atlanta. There was a tornado last year, and then right after the tornado, the next day, it was still very stormy. The skies were very angry-looking, so they were very cloudy. I made great photographs that day because of the overcast conditions and the way the clouds looked, and the clouds looked great on film. So that tends to be the same anywhere, whether it's Atlanta or Chicago or Paris. If it's cloudy outside, it's going to be pretty much the same lighting conditions.
Very, very cool. So are you souping all your own film? Tell me about your workflow after you've acquired these very cool images. What happens there?
Well, I used to, but now I get my film processed by a lab. Not really a lab anymore. It's a guy. The last color lab where you could go rent darkroom space and print your work, their equipment closed about a year and a half ago here in Atlanta. And the guy who used to run that processes my film now. It frees me up time to work on the printing of them. I print digitally now. I scan my negatives. I use a filed-out negative carrier, the same one that I always used in the darkroom. Put the negative in the negative carrier and just scan the whole thing, and then print them digitally. In the past, I would print all my black and white negatives on color paper. I'd use the filters in the enlarger to gain sort of the tone that I was looking for. I tend to print in maybe a bronze color. It's maybe similar to sepia, but it has a lot of green in it. It looks a little more contemporary than sepia. And I printed that way for years, and then when I could see that the lab was going to close, I wanted to start printing digitally, and so I sort of made the transition, and by having this other guy who used to run the lab process my film, it frees me up more time to work on the images, because it takes longer to get an image the first time now than it used to. I could go in the darkroom in the past, I'd get a great image in, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour. Now it takes me most of the day to get a great image, so when I shoot 30 or 40 rolls at a time. And instead of sitting down and processing film for a day or however long it would take me to process all that film, it's a better use of my time to work on the images and have him process the film all at one time in one or two batches, and they tend to be more consistent that way as well.
Very cool. So, of course, when you get this stuff in, you get it into Photoshop using Mac or PC?
I use a Mac.
Very cool. And then, like you said, you get these adjustments. How have you found this transition? I mean, like you said, it takes you much longer here, I think, to get things dialed in and get it correct for the digital print. How do you like what you're doing on digital compared to what you were doing when you were in the darkroom?
It's probably just like doing art shows for a living. I don't think I ever would have done it on my own where I left to my own devices. I was not interested necessarily in printing digitally. There was nothing about it that called me that said, come do this. There's nothing about it that drew me, but I was sort of forced into it, and now that I do it, it's just about the best thing in the world. It's fantastic. It does take me longer to get the first image, but I have so much more control over my contrast now than I used to. I don't think I fully realized at the time that my contrast wasn't as good as it could have been, but I was printing black and white negatives on color paper, so it was sort of a process. I wasn't the first one to come up with it, obviously, but I just sort of did it on my own, so there weren't as many controls as there would have been had it been a process that more people used. I didn't have much contrast control, and I thought that I did. I believe that I had more than I did. So now that I print digitally, I have infinite contrast control, so my blacks are right where I want them, my whites are right where I want them. So my prints look so much better than they used to. And frankly, they last longer. I used to print on, I won't mention the paper, but there was a couple of color papers that were supposed to be archival long life. I'd hang them in my booth, in my exhibit, at an art show, and so they hang for a couple of days. Not in the sun, but we're outside, so it's pretty bright outside. and then they'd be packed up again for a week or two, and then I'd do another show. So really maybe only 30 days or something, let's say, that they're hanging in the bright light, and maybe one of them gets wet, maybe it's raining, and rain on the glass leaks on into the mat, so the mat gets wet, so I have to replace the mat. I take it apart, and I could see these color prints around the edges where the mat was and where the mat wasn't. There's a difference in color, so there's obviously some sort of color change that was going on with that paper that maybe was too subtle to see when it was hanging on the wall, but was very easy to see once you took the mat apart and saw that the paper was a different color under the mat than it was not under the mat. And that doesn't happen now. Now, will they change eventually? I'm sure they will. I don't know how long, but I know that they last longer than the color prints that I used to do before. And that gives me a little bit of peace of mind that I'm not going to have somebody calling me in 10 years saying, this beautiful print that I bought from you has turned colors or changed. It's nice to know that I don't have to worry about dealing with that in the future. And maybe by the time that does eventually happen, I'll be dead and in the ground for 50 years. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, what can you do? You know, it's not your fault. Yeah. You didn't make it.
Right, I didn't manufacture the processes. That's right.
You have some very unique botanical images also up on your website that I think different from the Holga. It looks like maybe some are from Holga. So let's talk about that. I think these are beautiful, very shallow depth of field. Tell me how you made these. These are great.
Well, the botanicals serve two purposes. First, I've been shooting with the Holga for probably 4 or 5 years, and I was having a little bit of trouble being more creative. The economy changed a little bit, so I was less able to go to Europe and shoot, so I was having to be more creative in the things that I shot locally. You go shoot anything in Europe just about and it's going to sell because people are buying memories of their trip to Europe or maybe their memories they want to have of a trip that they want to take to Europe or whatever. So it's easy to sell images of Europe at art shows or whatever, whether they're fantastic or whether they're just okay. But you have to be more creative if I'm shooting more local things. And I was having trouble getting to that point. And so I wanted to try something different for a little while. Plus, I knew that I was changing over to the digital printing. And if I did a different work, it would help me learn how to use the printer. And so I shot a lot of botanicals in the studio with my view camera, using the tilt and swings on the view camera to get a very shallow depth of field. And I used Polaroid 55 negatives, which have great edges on them. So that's a black and white negative. And I scanned that negative in the computer and added all the color in the computer. I've added the color. The color's not natural. So when I go to print them, as long as the color looks good, no one's going to know whether that color was the color that I intended or didn't intend. So I figured that would help me learn how to use the printer without much loss in materials. If I made little mistakes in the color, nobody's going to know because I made the colors up in the first place. And they already look a little sort of painterly and not quite natural, which is what I was going for. I love the flowers, and I did them for a couple years, and I think I just probably did my last art show with them in St. Louis a couple of weeks ago. They're fantastic in the way that they look, but they just don't sell the way that the Holgas do. I think that the Holgas are so different in that very few other people at art shows sell Holga images, but they also don't sell Holga images that are multiple exposures. So people who come to art shows don't see images that are similar to the Holgas that I have very often. So they sell very well. I think when people see them, people who like them and want to buy them are very excited about them, and they like them a lot. The people who buy the flowers, the botanicals, they like them, but I think they're less excited about them. I think they like them, and they think that they'll match whatever scheme they have in their house, or that it's something that they can look at every day and not paid in 10 years or whatever, but I think they like it well enough. But the Holgas, I think people see them and they love them, people who buy them anyway. So they sell better, and for me personally, that's the way I feel about them. The images that I shoot with the Holga are very exciting to me, and the botanical ones that I shot are still exciting, but they're not exciting in the same way. They're not exciting in the different, oh my goodness, how did I get that kind of way. Especially the multiple exposures with the Holga. I'll shoot the same image over and over, maybe, say, 4 rolls of the same thing from different angles. I'll shoot it, turn the camera upside down, shoot it again on the same negative. Maybe I'll do 3 exposures on the same negative. I'll experiment a lot with it, and in those 4 rolls, there's going to be 1 or 2 that are going to be really fantastic, and then there's going to be maybe another 2 or 3 that are going to be really nice, and then the rest are going to be really awful. And so in getting those 1 or 2 that are really great, to me, that's sort of the thing that's really exciting. And when I see them, and they don't always look like I thought they were going to look because of the way the images combine together on that same negative, that's just much more exciting and fun to me. So the focus in the future will be more on the multiple exposures and more on the Holga things that I can do different things with.
Have you played around with, like, the Holga back that lets you shoot Fuji Instant Film now that there's no Polaroid or anything like that, or are you pretty much sticking with the black and white neg?
I'm pretty much sticking with the black and white negatives. Frankly, it may be another reason that I was open to the Holga when I sort of came upon it. At the time, I was doing the Polaroid transfers, and the Polaroid chemicals are a little caustic, and they don't bother some people, but they bothered me a little bit. The way that I work, I tend to work maybe in assembly line fashion. If I do Polaroid transfers, I do them all day. Or if I print all day. Because tomorrow I've got other things I need to do, and I'll probably do that all day. And so I would do these Polaroid transfers all day, and I would get maybe little dots of the chemicals on me, and I wouldn't be as good about wearing gloves, and I wouldn't wash it off as often as I should, and I'd get little alkaline burns. So I was trying to get away from the Polaroid chemicals.
So, Michael, let's talk about your very unique business model. I think it's very cool. I think at one point you had done some gallery work, but now pretty much if you want a Michael Bryant fine art image, you go find Michael on the road or from your website. So let's talk about this transformation from doing gallery work into being your own gallery. You're on the road. You're doing cool stuff. I think people would really like to hear about this. They always see stuff at little art shows or things downtown in their hometown and this and that, and they always wonder how that works. So let's talk about your transition from the traditional gallery type way of selling prints and making income to what you do these days.
Well, doing the art shows just gives me more freedom, I think. I used the galleries for a while. I liked the galleries well enough. But I'd like the art shows more in that I made more money that I had control over at the art shows. Whatever I made was mine. I didn't have to share it with anybody. And my time is more mine doing art shows. I'm willing to put up with the fact that I have to drive to different cities to set up in these different cities and do art shows. That doesn't bother me. In exchange for that, I don't have to go to work every day. I don't have to answer anybody else's phone. I don't have to put up with anybody that I'm not interested in doing business with. And just knowing that I don't have to do business with anybody that I don't want to do business with makes me much more amenable to putting up with maybe situations that are less pleasant or that I don't enjoy as much, or maybe customers who want more of a discount than I want to give them. I'm much more amenable to them than I would be, I think, if I were forced in that situation to deal with whatever was going on. So it gives me a lot more freedom, and I enjoy the time that is mine, that I can do what I want to. Sometimes it's fantastic, and sometimes it's not so fantastic. The economy comes and goes. 2000, we went to Europe 3 times on art shows, and I didn't do that many art shows that year. They were just fantastic that year. Shortly after that, they changed, and they've been sort of stumbling around the bottom, maybe, for the past 4 or 5 years. And bottom's probably not the right word, but it's bottom for me in that it's sort of the lowest point sales-wise that I've had for art shows. But it's still perfectly fine enough to make a living, but it's not where I'm fully funding my IRA every year and putting money away for retirement. And it's not the way that the economy was before. So I do miss those years, but I do know that those years will come back around again. And in selling directly to people at art shows, when that does happen, I know that I'll benefit from it more greatly than I would if I was selling just in galleries. Galleries would probably give me a different sort of freedom. I'd probably have more freedom to shoot just what I wanted all the time and spend less time on the framing and the printing and the things that you have to do art shows and sell to a lot of people. But I think I like the actual contact with people who buy from me. This way, I see when they're excited about a piece that they buy, and they tell me directly that they're excited about a piece they buy. And that kind of stokes me. It keeps me sort of going creatively. It helps me be interested in the next image that I'm going to shoot, because I know that when somebody buys this, they're going to be really excited about it. Whereas if I was selling it just a gallery, I might or might not actually talk to the person who bought the piece, and I might or might not see how excited or not excited they were about it. And I kind of feed off of that. So it's nice to get those compliments and to get feedback from people when they buy pieces from you. But art shows for a living, I enjoy doing them, and the people that you see at small little art shows like the Kynet, farmers markets, things like that, those are usually the people who are just starting out, and sometimes you do make your money back for the booth fee and all your expenses for those little small shows. Oftentimes you don't. It just depends. But those are the kind of shows that sort of let you know whether or not you are willing to do this for a living or do this for a partial living, or if you just want to do this as a hobby. Those shows will sort of let you know that. They'll tell you all the good things and bad things about art shows, about the hard work of setting up and the hard work of breaking down, and is it going to rain that day, and do you have to put up with the rain, and will your work get wet? Will your tent that you bought handle the rain? It sort of gets your feet wet and lets you learn whether or not that's something that you want to do. And it also helps you hone your sort of display and your presentation. It takes you a while, or at least it took me a while, to realize that you don't have to show everything that you have. You need to show stuff that you think will sell, but also stuff that looks good together. You don't have to show every image of every flower next to every image of every building, next to every image of every person that you shot, all together at the same time. You can hold those others back and show just your architectural images or just your botanical images, whatever images, but a body of work that works well together. And I think it takes people a long time to get to that point. At least it did for me.
You do a fair amount of shows in a bunch of different geographic locations. So you're driving around the country a fair amount here. What do you find that's hot? I mean, you got your stuff, people are eating it up, it's yummy. But you see the other guys that are there too, and have you noticed trends in what people are buying and looking for art-wise?
That tends to vary, say, with the neighborhood or the area of the country or town that you're in. I do very well in urban settings. I live in Atlanta, and I do when I'm inside the perimeter in Atlanta, when I'm where people who are more urban are located, all the in-town neighborhoods, the older neighborhoods, the people who live in older established neighborhoods. I do less well when I go farther out to the suburbs, and I do less well when I go to smaller towns that are farther away from bigger cities. But that's not true for everybody. Some people do better farther out. Some people do better where it's relatively rural. So it just depends on the area. That seems to be more important for me anyway than maybe the time of year or anything like that. It seems certain people in certain areas tend to like certain things. Like black and whites just don't sell in certain areas, it seems. And then in other areas, big, bright, colorful abstracts, you couldn't give them away. But then you do a show in another area and those works would sell very, very well. So you have to find sort of your market, find where the people who would be more likely to be interested in your work are located. I also do very well in town Chicago. All these neighborhoods in town and those people who live in those neighborhoods like my work. They're interested in my work. I'm sure there's all sorts of psychological reasons why that is. And that's not what I do for a living, so I couldn't tell you what they were.
Right. I think you're right. I think maybe it's the point that you have very cosmopolitan type imagery. You have a lot of European stuff, and maybe you find that people that are within the city maybe are educated different mindset, and then they're more drawn towards your imagery.
I'm sure that's true, and especially the images that are, I don't want to say out there, but that are maybe a little bit more different, like the abstracts, the multiple exposures. I have this one great shot that's five exposures on one negative, and it's the front of a church in Italy, and I just moved around the front of it and shot it from different angles, so the church looks like it's shaken or something a little bit. And people in town neighborhoods tend to love that piece. They think it's fantastic. And some other people just don't get it at all. They're not interested in it at all. It doesn't do anything for them. It doesn't move them in any way. So I'm sure that that probably has something to do with why people like that piece or don't like that piece, where they were educated, where they live, what interests them. The fact that they are interested in architecture, maybe it's one of the reasons maybe that someone would live in a big city. They'd be interested in art. They'd be interested in the things that a big city brings. And they live in that big city, and they like big city sort of things, like buildings.
Sure. No, I think it's very interesting different. To see and how that changes, I'm sure, if you're in Albuquerque compared to Chicago.
Oh, I do know that I've done very few Southwestern shows because I know that when you do shows in the Southwest, Southwestern sort of themes on the whole sell more than they would, say, on the East Coast. And so since my themes are so different from that, I have done very few shows out there because I don't believe that I would do that well because I have not a lot of color and a lot of architecture that looks very European and East Coasty. And so that would make a difference in how well I would sell if I did a show in, say, Tucson.
Maybe it's time for the cactus.
It might be.
Yeah, shoot some cacti. This way you can make it out west.
I did a show in Sausalito, and I drove through the country, and I shot some great clouds. I probably shot 30 or 40 rolls of clouds just driving through the country there in the sort of desert area. I had never been to that part of the country, and I think how really large the sky was fascinated me. Now, you've heard about the big sky before, and I'd heard that over and over, but I didn't really get it until I drove through there and saw how massive the sky really was. I guess it's because it's so flat. Maybe you can see so far. I don't know, but it was really beautiful, and I shot a lot of film. And I just haven't had a chance to do anything with that yet, but I'm sure I will soon. I'm working on some things that are more nature-inspired, more grasses and birds and things like that, and less buildings lately. That's what I'm sort of focusing on.
Very, very cool. So let's talk about where we can find out where Michael's going to be. How's the show circuit work with what these art shows that you've been up to? Where can they find out if they want to see your work in person? Because I think you have more stuff typically with you in person than you have on your website. I mean, how's all that work?
Oh, well, I always have more with me than I have on the website. Plus, I have more things with me. Since I shoot all the time and I introduce pieces all the time, I might introduce a piece that I just shot a couple of weeks ago. And I have somebody else actually manage the website, so it will take months to get up on the website. And it's probably only once a year that the website's fully changed out. I'll change out about a third of the images or a quarter of the images and put a whole lot of brand new pieces on there. In December, when I don't do art shows, that's when I can focus a whole lot of time on creating a new look for the website and many new images for the website. But throughout the year, I do art shows all over the country. There's a link on my website. It's michael-bryant.com where they can sign up to get my art show schedule. I usually send it out about two or three times a year that shows the art shows that I'll be in around the country. And then if I do an art show near the city where someone lives, if they live in Chicago or near Chicago, a week or so before the show, they'd get an email that would say that I was going to be at the Old Town Art Fair or wherever. And if I know my booth number, it would be in there as well to give them that information. But I do tend to travel a lot all over the country in the summer. And then by the fall, I tend to get more neighborhood shows around Atlanta or even some neighborhood shows in Chicago or St. Louis. And then in the winter, very few shows, but maybe a couple of shows just after the first of the year in Florida. And then starting in the spring, I'll start traveling around again. I try to use the wintertime to finish pieces that I've been working on, to work on new looks, to work on my booth. This year I'm working on a new presentation. I'm working on maybe embedding the images in encaustics or using some acrylics or some sort of different way to present them. It'd be nice to be able to get away from the glass and from the mats because they add a lot of weight to the piece and add a lot of weight that I have to carry around in the van and that I have to hang and unhang and put back in the box. So I'm trying different things presentation-wise that would maybe cut down on the weight and would be a little more different to look at, I think. If I can embed them in encaustics, which is just like a wax, a beeswax mixed with paint pigments or clear, it would give it a different look, maybe a more luminous look. It would be protected from the rain, so if it got wet, it would be less likely to be damaged. And I think it would be maybe more exciting to look at. I don't know. We'll see. I'm sort of working on that right now.
Yeah, I guess that would be a concern with driving around with all this art with glass and all these frames to deal with and making sure stuff doesn't get beat up. Do you find that people want stuff pre-framed? They want to just be able to buy it and go home and hang it on the wall? What do you typically see with people that are going to art shows looking for fine art?
Well, for me, I tend to use all the same frame molding in the booth, and it tends to be a molding that looks really good with my work. That's the first consideration, as opposed to framing work in a molding that just costs me less, that would save me money. I don't do that. I want the look, the work that's hanging on the wall to look as good as it can. So I use a molding that looks really good and costs a little bit more. And so people who are interested in larger pieces almost always buy them framed because of the way that they're presented in the booth. They look so good on their own. And they tend to be a relatively neutral frame, it's sort of a warm silver frame with a little bit of black in there as well, that looks contemporary but also would match with things that were less contemporary in somebody's home. So it's a frame that a lot of people like. There's some people who just want stuff unframed because they have a particular aesthetic in their house that they want to match. Maybe everything in their house is framed in black frames, or maybe they have a particular thing going on in the house and they want to match exactly what they have going on. And those people wouldn't buy a frame piece no matter what kind of frame that you had. But most people who buy larger pieces almost always buy them framed. And I sell a smaller, unframed piece for around $49 so that I can sell to as many people as possible. And people who buy those most often buy them unframed, but occasionally they do buy them framed. I think that the appeal of those pieces is probably the price point. The fact that for $49 you can get an original piece of art that not everybody in the world is going to have. In fact, less than 200 people will have because they're limited in number to 200. So they're not going to go to IKEA or Walmart or Target or anywhere else and see it hanging on the wall and know that everybody in the world has it. It's going to be one of 200.
No, I think it's great. And it's great to see that you actually have a price point set that a normal consumer can go to a show, enjoy something, and actually walk away with something and feel happy about it. But it doesn't break the bank.
Oh, that's right. And not all artists can do that. But as a photographer, that is something that I'm able to do. If I was a painter or a sculptor, that would probably be much more difficult for me to do. But I can do that as a photographer, and it served me well. It kept me going. In times where the economy was a little slow, the fact that I had a very low price point for some pieces in the booth, I was able to do okay, as opposed to maybe someone who didn't, and the economy was a little slower, and they had less success at a show because all their pieces were much more expensive. But at the same time, it's nicer to have the larger pieces on the wall that are much more expensive, that are going to draw the people who are interested in a larger piece for their house. And those larger expensive pieces tend to draw more attention and draw people in. Maybe they'll draw people who can't afford that larger expensive piece, but they will buy that smaller one because they were so impressed by the larger, more expensive one that is on the wall.
I think, too, that everybody has the deal with the economy. It's bad, bad, but there's still people out there with money.
Oh, there are. I don't want to make the economy sound like it's just awful and dreadful. I'm not standing on the corner with a can saying, please feed me, I'm broke. It's not like that at all. I'm doing just fine. It's not fantastic. I'm not socking money away, but I'm making a living.
Right. But I think it's great, though, that you can offer this. But still, you have this variety and range within your exhibit to be able to offer something from $49 to $500.
I think right now my most expensive piece is about $1,300 that I hang in the booth. But it just depends on what I've sort of worked out that year economy-wise, what I think is going to work and what I think I'm going to be able to do and how I think I'm going to be able to price things. You don't want to overprice things, but you also don't want to underprice things as well. If things don't cost enough in your booth, there are people who won't see any value in the piece, and so they wouldn't buy it, whereas they would buy it if it were more expensive. So it's almost a dance that you have to do to find where's the middle ground. I want to make a living, but I don't want to have to sell things so cheaply that I spend all my time producing work constantly, and I don't have time to create new work because I'm constantly producing this older, inexpensive work. You want to have time to create newer, more expensive pieces to let you spend more time on the pieces and less time on the actual production of the piece. More time on thinking about the piece and thinking about what you're going to do next. But it's a fine line. You got to find what works for you, how to get there. And it's different for everybody.
Yeah, but you have some beautiful imagery here. This is great stuff. It's cool to see that you're in control of your art and you're taking the stuff on the road. It sounds like a pretty fun lifestyle.
It has its moments. On the whole, I love it, actually. I really like the traveling around and the freedom. And seeing things like, say, Chicago in the summer is a fantastic city, but I don't have to put up with the winter there. Atlanta is fantastic in the fall, and I don't have to put up with the summer very much here. So you get to see a lot of parts of the country that are really lovely that I don't think I would get to see otherwise. And I don't have to put up with probably Atlanta's biggest drawback, which is traffic. I don't have to put up with that because I don't get out and go to work every day. On the road, I walk downstairs to the studio, and there's no traffic but the cat, and that works out okay.
And since you're in town, you get to go to Mary Max and have dinner, so that's not too bad either.
That's right, yeah.
Michael, this is beautiful photography, really cool stuff. I appreciate you spending some time with us to tell us about how you're doing this great work. And it's very cool, it's refreshing, and it's very cool to see what you're doing with the Holga. This is beautiful stuff.
Great, thanks for your interest. I appreciate that.
Well, there you go. Michael Bryant, beautiful work, very cool images, and of course, all made with film and a Holga. Just cool stuff going on with Michael. Definitely check out his website. If you get a chance to go to one of the places he's going to be showing his art, you definitely got to check out it. It's just beautiful work. The Inside Analog Photography Radio Program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Chipper, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.